What's up? What's up? Welcome to another episode of All Over Voiceover, Kip VH. I'm your host, Kip VH. And with me, my new friend, the talented, the delightful Zara Fuzzle. Welcome. Did
Hello.
I say it right?
Yes,
I
said
it
right? You did. You said it perfectly.
All right, good.
Well done.
I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we were just talking about social media, like the fact that about 15 minutes ago, we were tweeting back and forth about, oh, I'm on my way, and this is going to be super fun.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm thrilled that you're here. Because we literally met, like, on Twitter. You were
right.
Asking me before we started, like, how did you find me and
yeah.
stuff? I don't know. Like, you...
In the ether. I was always there.
You were always there. Zara, you appeared magically on my timeline. No, I mean, I don't... I honestly don't know. It was one of those things where...
Well, I remember when I... Yes, I remember when I started following you on social media. I think it was a couple years ago... I did a panel at LA Comic Con.
Yeah.
And I read you did a panel as well. You organized a panel, right?
Yes, Voice NATO.
Yes. I think that's when I first heard about you and started following you on social media. And then I just liked the things you were saying. I was
awesome.
This guy is like really cool. And then you started listening to your podcast much later. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. I mean, I saw, you know, like, you know, we connected via the feed and I saw your the variety of your work. And the quality of your work and your like just the breadth of your stuff is just really fascinating. Well, that's great. I've read your bio and
you.
Your wiki page and stuff.
Oh,
but,
gosh.
But let's.
There's some information on there that's not correct.
That's
Let me just come out and say that.
That's
now.
All right. Do you ever edit it?
You're not
touch
allowed.
It? You're
well,
not allowed?
So real quick. When my Wikipedia page first went up, it was very detailed and kind of focused on one or two live theater shows I did over a decade ago.
Wow.
And the way it was written, I panicked. It also mentioned something about my parents, and I panicked. And I made an account on Wikipedia, and I just deleted it all.
Yeah.
Because I was panicked. And then the person who initially had created that page, who I guess was one of the administrators, I don't know what they're called on Wikipedia, said, hey, just so you know, it's called blanking when you delete a mass amount of information at once. Blanking isn't really cool. And if you're the person who this page is about, you shouldn't be editing it. And I was like, oh, so I freaked out. I reached out to some friends who were in PR.
Yeah.
Like, is there anything I can do about this? And they said, essentially, it's seen as bad practice for public figures to edit their own Wikipedia pages. People have gotten in trouble for it in the past, like
really?
Celebrities. Yeah. And so the only way to counter information on your Wikipedia page is just to do more published interviews, more articles, so that truer facts can outweigh the stuff you don't want as much on the page.
That's insane.
Isn't that insane?
That's completely insane.
And I mean, I get it, because Wikipedia, they're trying to create this unbiased,
right.
objective, but yeah, it feels really weird and invasive.
I agree.
I don't know. What's your Wikipedia page like?
Well,
like,
I mean, it's, mine is kind of, it was one of those things where, I was like, hey, I went to Second City Detroit's Wikipedia page and I saw other people who had done credits and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't listed in there. I was like, yeah, I've done some cool things. I've done some stuff in there. I wonder what I got to do to get on Wikipedia.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I was like, well, I didn't know the protocol. So I created a page for it and then it got deleted. And I was like, oh, I guess I can't do that, huh? All right. And then something sparked up and... just little pieces kind of came in. And it's super vague. And I had that same impulse of like, I'm going to go in there and I'll just update it with information. Because I thought it's like, it's a community and I'm a guy.
Helpful.
Yeah, I'm just trying to help give some stuff, but, you know, curating it. So, I don't know. I haven't checked it recently, so I don't know if anyone's kind of jumped on and added stuff.
Yeah.
Since I did Richie Rich, then there's been more activity of things and... you know, of kids and stuff. But it's funny how, like, Wikipedia seems to be not as much in vogue as other social media things are. Or
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Totally. I feel like, you know, when I am interested in learning more about another actor, I always go to their Instagram first. That's
yeah.
kind of my first impulse now, because I feel like I can get a visual smattering and understanding instantly of not who they are as a person necessarily, but, like, where they are in the scheme of things,
yeah.
what sort of things are they focused on? What genre? You know, just a general sense of, oh, okay, this is how you move in this world.
Yeah, there's something about that particular platform that just feels a little bit more, I mean, no pun intended, but kind of accurate snapshot in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's, yeah, and I know that it's completely a curated thing.
Sure.
And certain Instagram accounts feel more curated than others, for better or for worse. And I don't know, I find, as someone who puts a great deal of thought into my Instagram, the curation of my Instagram, like, how do I not seem disingenuous even though I'm totally curating it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I want to circle back to that.
For sure.
Drop a bookmark in, because I'm fascinated on how, you know, what your process is like in that aspect of it, because it's necessary. And my Instagram game is literally like Spider-Man sweatshirts, coffee, and smoking cats. It's ridiculously stupid, but that's just me. Where are you from?
I'm from Indiana.
What part of Indiana?
West Lafayette, where Purdue University is.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you were my neighbor to the north.
That's right.
That's yay.
Great. How long would you you grow up? Did you go to college there and stuff?
So I was born outside of Chicago.
Okay.
And then my family moved down to West Lafayette. My dad was a psychiatrist, and he opened a private... He was teaching down in West Lafayette at Wabash College at one point, but then he opened a private practice. And so I spent, you know, age 3 through age 16 in West Lafayette all the way through high school. And then for college, I was really itching to leave my hometown.
I understand that completely.
Yeah. And so I applied to a bunch of schools, ended up getting into Wellesley College just outside of Boston.
Yeah.
And so that's where I went to college.
Very cool. Very cool. What was your course of study? Were you studying theater and stuff, or were you?
So I actually wanted to be an animator.
Really?
Yes. And my thought was, Wellesley had this great joint program with MIT, with the MIT Media Lab, and you could kind of build your own media arts and sciences major. And so I thought, great, I'm going to study VFX. I'm going to study computer graphics animation. Yeah. I want to be an animator. I kind of got sidetracked by the theater department, as one tends to do.
What was that moment? Like, well, going back, like with animation, was that something that you were, was it just a fan of cartoons and stuff?
Yes. I, as long as I can remember, I love cartoons so much. As far back as I can remember, I remember waking up early on Saturday mornings to watch the ABC Disney block of shows. Yeah. I remember coming home from school and watching the Disney Afternoon.
Yep. Tailspin.
Tailspin. Darkwing Duck.
Darkwing Duck.
Gargoyles.
Uh-huh.
I was huge. And my love of those shows, specifically my love of Gargoyles, got me into comic books, because I wanted to pick up the Gargoyles comic book, the companion book to the series that Marvel published
in
94, 95. And that got me into the world of comics and visual storytelling. And I started to draw. And so it was kind of all these things where I was like, okay, I love storytelling and I love this visual medium of storytelling. And I loved the actors. I remember tracking who was in what show, because so many of the same actors were in the Disney Afternoon. Like Jim Cummings, for example.
Yeah.
He was Darkwing, and he was a bunch of other characters in that show. And then in Bonkers, he was both Bonkers and Lucky Pickell. He was like the two leads of the show. I was like, this is amazing. And so I just remember loving everything about animation and knowing that I wanted to be a part of it. And at that time, I thought it was through the physical act of animating.
That's the way it seems possible, too. I feel like in the Midwest, that there was something about being behind the microphone that seemed somehow out of reach, and the technical aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
At least for my case, I felt like if I wanted to be involved in some kind of production, it was going to have to be in a technical way. Even if I liked to perform, it just, the mythos around it was that it's impossible to do.
Yeah.
At least that was my experience.
Yeah. You know, a little bit about my background. My parents were immigrants from Pakistan who came to the U.S. in the 70s. They were both doctors. And they were... The South Asian culture is not, sadly, not well known for supporting kids going into the arts, and especially not in the 90s, early 2000s when I was growing up. But my parents were incredibly supportive in a way that I'm so thankful.
Yeah.
Whether it's because they had the foresight to like see gifts in their children, or whether it's because my dad's side of the family was very involved and is still involved in Bollywood, in the Indian film industry.
No kidding.
Yeah. So he grew up seeing that, oh, one can make a living in the arts. And so I was encouraged to explore my love of the arts and see what I could do to make a career out of it. But, you know, why don't you be smart about it? Why don't you learn computer animation rather than just fine arts and drawing? Yeah. Why don't you get an MBA in addition to looking at master's programs in musical theater? You know?
Nurture your love for it, but have a fallback plan. Yeah. Have something practical.
Yes. Yeah. So I think the practicality is probably what initially is like, oh, I don't know if I could be the actor, but yeah, I definitely could be part of the whole that might have more job security.
Yeah.
But my animator friends are probably laughing hearing this, like, job security, what are you talking about?
Yes, right. So you go to college.
Yes.
And what was the moment that what was the siren song from the theater department that drew you away from?
Oh man!
Or did you follow through it and then chase it after, or it was all happened? The transition happened in college.
It was two things I can boil it down to. The transition happened in college. I think it was my. I was so one thing. I was also my major was Japanese language and literature.
Oh wow!
And the reason I studied Japanese so much to the point where it became my major is that I became obsessed with this all-female musical theater company in Japan called the Takarazuka Review.
Uh-huh.
They've been around for over 100 years. They do original musicals, but also adaptations of Western musicals.
Oh my gosh.
And Western movies. Like one of their most popular shows now is a stage musical adaptation of Ocean's 11. And it's all women, and the women play the men's roles. And, you know, Wellesley is an all-women's school. And so, you know, when I would do plays at Wellesley, I was often cast as a guy because my voice was lower and I was taller. And I loved playing guys because that's where the fun, meaty parts are.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually where some of the better roles are going to find, sadly. Right. That's true.
And so I became fascinated with this way of gender performance on stage in Japan. And I ended up doing an internship with the theater company.
Oh my gosh.
At one point, yeah. And translating their one of their musicals to produce and direct at Wellesley as my senior thesis.
Wow.
So that kind of, while I majored in Japanese language and literature, it was really because of my love for the theater and specifically examining the ins and outs of this one very specific type of acting.
What is the nature of the style of performance for this group?
It's highly theatrical. It's not so theatrical and presentational as like no or kabuki, highly stylized forms of theater. But it's not that Western realism. It's not Stanislavski. It's not. When you see it, you're very aware that you're watching a play, you're watching theater, something that is hyper-realism, gotcha. I guess I would describe it.
Okay.
Almost verging on the melodramatic. But I could talk your ear off about how like Asian theater cultures, it's more because it's coming from like a different place. It's that hyper, they don't want realism. These traditional forms go to those extremes of emotions in order to evoke that from their audience.
More operatic in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good word to describe it.
That's so fascinating.
So that was like one thing that I was like, oh, I want to be a performer. The other thing was, and this might be a little spiteful, but I think I was in a class my sophomore year, an art class, a visual arts class, and every week we had these weekly, you know, sketchbook assignments we had to turn into our professor, and our professor would leave notes. And I remember one time the professor left a note that said, "Hey, Zara, you seem a little limited in your thinking. Why don't you try XYZ? And to me, to like 17-year-old, 18-year-old Zara, that was like the cruelest thing you could say to me.
Yeah.
About being limited in my thinking.
Yeah, right. Oh.
So rather than taking the note and trying to understand it, I think I got a little defensive and frustrated and realized I don't know if I want to feel this way about this thing that I enjoy and I love so much, which is visual drawing.
Yeah.
I don't know that I could hack it professionally, getting notes and being told to change things, and it would suck the fun out of it, and I don't love it enough to want to persist through that.
Yeah.
And it, for me then, the media, I knew I wanted to be a storyteller. The medium through which it would happen was open for debate.
Yes.
And at that time, I moved away from visual storytelling and more into my own body as performance. Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic. I'm always fascinated by those blocks or those things that happen that, like some person making an offhanded comment, or I don't know, it should, like, my ex-mother-in-law, I remember saying at one point, you know, I don't know if you really can make a living doing that and providing for the family, can you? And, you know, we were married and I wanted to pursue a career in the arts, and that idea, in a weird way, became rocket fuel for, no, I'm going to show you just how much I can make and just how much I can provide for a family. I'm going to be all right.
Yes.
And it's funny there's not even necessarily malice in it. It's right. It's just sort of a.
She was doing her job, my professor. She was trying to direct me to a place I needed to go to improve. And I, for whatever reason, it didn't resonate with me in a way that was helpful for moving that forward.
Right. And you find that space to be like, I need to protect that thing.
Yeah.
As a thing or, yeah. That's so fascinating. It's interesting to like discover those things and, you know, upon either reflection or knowing in that moment.
And it's amazing because it works both ways, because you encounter things like your ex-mother-in-law said, that gives you the boost to then go off and do the thing, like you said, the rocket fuel.
Yeah.
And so there are those moments where it's a no and you're like, okay, and you run with it. But then there's also those nurturing moments of it's a yes and you go and run with it.
That's right.
And both are like, I think when you have those moments, they sear into your memory like, here was a turning point.
Yeah.
Here was something that propelled me forward.
Yeah.
Whether it was a yes or a no.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so great. So after college,
yes.
What do you do? You've changed. You've got a degree in
Japanese language and literature.
And did you minor in theater at that point, or was it more extracurricular? Or what
I was going to double major with media arts and sciences. Like that was still. I took all the art classes up to. I was like 2 credits shy.
Yeah.
And I told my father this on graduation day, much to his chagrin.
I thought we were no.
Right. I'm like, I'm graduating with honors in Japanese. Hey, come on.
That's right.
And no, I didn't take a ton of theater classes in our theater department. I just did as many plays as I could.
Yeah.
So where voiceover kind of comes into it a little bit.
Yeah.
Backtracking, before I started college, the summer after my senior year of high school, as I said, I was a huge fan of the Disney show Gargoyles.
Yeah.
And at that time, there was a yearly convention called The Gathering for Gargoyles fans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This dedicated group of fans started it in like 1997 and then just grew it bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And so in 2001, it was in Los Angeles. And as a graduation present, my father, I asked my father if we could go. He said yes. He took us out. And it was amazing because I'd been to comic book conventions and sci-fi conventions as a kid. My mom would take me, and like I'm a huge nerd. Like there's no way around it.
High five!
Yay! I really love the things that I love very passionately. And so it was there at that gathering of Gargoyles that I met Greg Wiseman.
Oh wow!
Yeah, who is the showrunner of Young Justice? Was the showrunner of Gargoyles, Spectacular Spider-Man, so many others. And he cast a radio play at the convention where he would bring a script from an episode of a show and cast convention attendees and original voice actors to all read together.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I was this little 16-year-old obsessed with Gargoyles, and I auditioned for him, and I got cast as Elisa Maza, the female lead. And he told me, you know, he was like, go to college, but then when you're done, consider coming out to Los Angeles, because I really think you could have a career in animation. I was like, thanks, Greg, okay. Like, filing that away.
Yeah.
Never really revisited it until much later. So I graduated from college. Uh-huh. I had applied to a couple MFA programs because at that point I was like, I want to do musical theater. Uh-huh. I didn't get into the schools I applied to, so I went back home to Indiana for the summer.
Okay.
That was a tough summer. Yes. It's like, I don't know what to do from here. And I have amazing older sisters, and one of my sisters was living in Washington, D.C. at that time, and she's literally a rocket scientist by training. Yeah. But she also is an actor, and at that time she was acting in a ton of regional theater in D.C., which is a fantastic theater city.
Yeah.
And she was like, you know what, come stay with me for a while, no rent, like audition for things, look for jobs.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. And so that was the next thing I did. And I ended up living and working in D.C. on and off for about 6 years.
Oh, that's great.
Doing as many shows as I could.
Do you know the Keegan Theater?
Yes, they do Irish plays.
My friend Susan Birnbaum, I think her last name is the name of the guy, of Mark is her husband.
Oh, okay.
But we were friends in college, and that's hilarious.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so cool. I think I did a show with them.
Did you really?
Yes, As American As, I think was the title of the show. But yeah, DC's that's so great. Wild.
Yeah, that's such a robust artistic community. There's so much going on and really interesting, innovative work.
Yes, Woolly Mammoth Theater is just fantastic. And like, I think unfortunately when outside of DC, when you mention DC, people are like, oh, politics. You know, that's what you think is front and center in DC. And yes, it is, but that's not all that's there.
Yeah.
It's got, like you said, it's a thriving, robust artistic community.
Yeah.
A lot of cool new work and often stuff before it goes to New York will be workshopped at some of the major theaters in DC.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So you do 6 years in DC doing stuff, and what was one of your favorite pieces that you did while you were there?
I worked a little bit with a theater company there called Synetic, which is inspired by Georgian dance, Georgia the country.
Oh, wow.
And so they were famous for doing silent adaptations of Shakespeare plays done through movement.
Oh, my God.
And they were these amazing, like, dance, not quite dance, but not quite. It was like this mix of dance and movement and acting.
Yeah.
Traditional theater acting, like, all together to create these just, like, beautiful gothic shows. And so I did a couple shows with them. That was really fun. We did an adaptation of Lysistrata. That was a collaboration between the Synetic Theater Company and Georgetown University.
Okay.
And so that was a really interesting blend of professionals and students just learning together and working together and innovating, creating new stuff together. That was so much fun.
What a trip.
Oh, yeah. And I did quite a bit of solo shows during that time too, where I adapted or wrote original pieces and toured them around to different fringe festivals.
Oh, great.
DC has a great fringe festival, Capital Fringe. There's nothing like a summer theater festival to really, you know, get in the spirit, the thespian spirit.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. The energy around that, and different artists doing innovative and interesting things and surprising each other and surprising yourself in the process.
Yeah.
And working on something for a couple months and then putting it out there and people having their minds blown.
There's nothing like it.
I agree.
Yeah. I got to do that again. But it's like when you're younger, you don't know any better. You're like, yeah, of course I'll do a show. And yeah, it opens in 2 weeks. Yeah, I'll finish the final draft and it's going to be great. And
we'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. That's and you right. do. You do yeah. figure it out.
That's right.
Yeah.
So how do you transition from that community to finding yourself working out here? And did you come directly out or did you knock around or what was your process?
I think in the back of my head, I had always either wanted to come here to Los Angeles or I wanted to move to Japan and work in the theater scene there. I think I was a little too scared to make that big of a jump at the time to commit to another country, another culture, another language that I was proficient in, but wouldn't be without its challenges.
Yeah.
Like, I think I lived in Japan for about a year during college.
Oh, wow.
And I recommend to anybody, especially young people, study a foreign language and go spend a little bit of time in a place where that language is spoken, because it's so, it teaches you so much when you maybe understand what's happening 70% of the time. And that 30, you have to trust that you'll get it, or that it's okay to live in the unknowing.
Yes.
I think that's such a valuable life skill.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
It teaches you trust in yourself. Mm-hmm. It reinforces your cognitive ability to make connections and put things together.
Yeah.
And that helps in so many other ways where you don't start painting, you know, sorry, I'm sliding into metaphor, but you don't start putting monsters in the closet. If you get in the habit of trusting that things are okay in that gap of knowledge,
yes,
that you don't create madness for yourself in that gap.
Because yeah.
Life is filled with those unknowns.
Totally.
You know?
Absolutely. And especially in a freelance creative career,
yeah.
that's the business is trusting the unknown and reaching into it and leaving space for the unknown.
Yeah.
For things to meet you in that dark unknown. For the lights to emerge.
The lights will emerge. As if like runway lights, and then it's like James Cameron's floating creatures in the bottom of the abyss. And all of a sudden you're illuminated by this magic. You're like,
yes.
Where did this come from?
Yes.
It's been here all the time. It's just the lights weren't ready to turn on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. It's funny. That aspect of it, I don't know why it makes me think of like, when I teach a new improv game, it's the same thing. Where it's like teaching people to go, just trust that someone in the group knows what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And relinquish your need to control.
Yes.
And just be in the moment and pattern recognize.
Yes.
And when you work that particular skill, you start to discover, because life is a series of patterns that we obey or try to break.
Yeah.
And, you know. Oh, it's so cool.
And like impulse recognition, when an impulse comes to you, recognize like, okay, now it is my time to speak.
Yeah.
I am sure of it. Now is my time to act. Now is my time to make this decision. Sometimes there's just the trusting that you'll do what you need to do when the time is right. Your body will tell you.
Yes.
And as much as you can just tune into that other thing, the better you'll do. The more trust you'll have.
Yes.
Yeah,
the more, well, the more you you sharpen that impulse,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of making like a blind left turn, or it's like the force in a way or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
All those things, but those are skills that need honing.
Yes,
and that's a great recommendation of, you know, learn a language and go to a place where you're not 100%.
Yeah, yeah. Why did I bring that up?
Because you were thinking about whether to go to Japan or come to Los Angeles.
That's right. That's right. Ultimately, I had done, so in 2011, I had done the Hollywood Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
I was touring a solo show around that time. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to scope out LA on this trip. And I think I had a couple more commitments through the end of that year. But then I'm like, okay, then I think I'm going to move to LA. And so that's what I did. I moved to LA in January of 2012.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I had kept in touch with Greg Wiseman all through the years. And he'd just been this wonderful mentor. And periodically we would meet up when we were in the same city or at a convention.
So,
and He's the best. Remotely, I had auditioned for a couple of his projects, Spectacular Spider-Man, and then when I moved out here, I had the opportunity to audition for Star Wars Rebels.
Oh, man.
And so I knew moving out here, I wanted to focus on on-camera television and voiceover for animation.
Yeah.
And I knew probably I could get the voiceover machine up and running sooner, and that would financially set me up in a better place, so then I could focus on other aspects of acting.
Yes.
And I'm so glad that that's what I did. Because, you know, I moved here, I took a few months to just get my bearings, like, got a job at a restaurant, got a job tutoring, found a place to live, found what grocery store I would go to, you know, all the essentials.
Yes.
Got my oil changed. And then a few months in, I had made some demos, commercial narration and animation, some basic demos with a friend in, with a sound engineer friend in DC.
Did you chase any of that work in DC at all? Or
no, not at all. Which is so interesting to me that I'd taken one voiceover class in Boston while I was in school.
Uh-huh.
But then I hadn't thought about voiceover specifically for years, really. I guess I linked it so much to this place because that's where the animation is.
Yes.
Even though I was interested in doing commercials and narration and phone trees and everything, I always linked it to this place for that reason.
I understand.
Yeah. And cold called a couple studios to see like if there was they had a demo bin or if I could, you know, email them my stuff.
Yeah.
And the second place I called, the producer was like, I need you.
What?
I was like, yeah, exactly. That was my response. I'm like, excuse me? And he's like, I was actually about to post an audition for something, but I'm hearing you on the phone. You sound like you might be perfect for it. Can you come in and read tomorrow? And I was like, okay. And so I went in the next day and it was for an airline radio talk show where I'm the host and I'm interviewing it's like paid programming for the airlines.
Sure.
Where businesses can like buy an interview and time and they play it on like the business class.
Yeah, the little
radio.
the arm radio.
Yeah, the arm.
The one that you plug your own headphones in or you can pay a buck and get like chintzy little headphones and listen.
Yes.
What studios were you calling, like recording studios?
Yes, I was too intimidated to call agencies.
Uh-huh.
I didn't really know at that point the difference between a casting director and a casting agent because the market was so different in DC.
Yeah.
And so I thought, but if I can start with things and be like the in-house person, maybe that's a smarter way to go.
Huh.
And it was that point, it was just like meeting people.
Yes.
And almost sheer desperation. I hate making phone calls, like, you know, but it's so good. Cold calling is so good. And
yeah.
It's a skill that I feel like I'm losing the more I don't do it. And I feel like collectively as a culture, we're losing because everything is just so digital and so instant that way.
Yes.
That the art of talking to someone, especially someone you can't see.
Yeah.
It's so intimidating, but it's so good, and there's nothing like it. And that's another thing I encourage young people to do, within reason. Don't harass anybody. Don't
right.
be annoying. But cold call, business sales cold call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's a skill that you need to hone.
Yes.
Because it's putting you back in your ear and connecting to another person.
Yeah.
Huh.
And so through that job that I booked with the airline radio talk show, I got to know, this was at the time North Hollywood Sound, which is now Dave and Dave.
Oh, yeah.
Rick Dasher, Mark De La Fuente, all those great, they're fantastic, the producers there. And that became my voiceover home.
Wow.
And they essentially, you know, they teach classes there and they help me do audiobooks. And so like whenever they had something, they would keep me in mind. And so it created this environment of like, okay, this is my home creative base now in LA. I'm so thankful. And, you know, they introduced me to so many people who then, you know, your network grows and flourishes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I did my first animation demo there. And that was kind of the turning point for me here in LA with voiceover to connect with them. And
that's terrific.
Yeah.
That's such an interesting way of approaching things. I think, I mean, I teach an intro class over at Second City.
Uh-huh.
And like so many people will be like, well, I need to get a demo and I need to get an agent. I need to get an MO and I need to get an agent. And my agents have said, get good, we'll be here when you're ready.
Uh-huh.
But that's also like, at the end of the day, you just need to log hours behind a microphone, you know? So much the better if you have someone on the other side of the glass going, do that again.
Yes.
You know? You're getting your ear or something just to give you a little tweak, but...
Yeah.
But to be able to, and I think too, like that sense of having a connection or having someone who's like, who likes you.
Yeah.
Just making you feel like you're not an intruder.
Yes.
You know?
Right. You're welcome here. You're one of us.
Yeah.
Yes. You're
oh,
part of
terrific.
The, oh, it was amazing. And like, just like you said about logging hours behind a mic, initially I did a lot of audiobook work through ACX where I'd bid on projects and record. Dude, like there is nothing like learning your instrument when you're just listening to hours and editing hours of yourself.
I did probably 7 books via ACX.
Oh, cool.
And like, you know, I didn't expect to make a ton of money doing it, but Like, it made me a better editor. It made me a better reader. And now I'm narrating for Hachette more frequently. I'm in the process of a book right now.
Oh, cool.
And, like, being able to have that experience as an editor helps me respect the editors who are doing the project. You know
I
mean? Where it's like, oh, you know, because it can be, it's always a challenge.
Challenge. Yeah.
How many books have you done?
Oh, like, my gosh. I did a series of books for one of Hawaii's top psychics.
Awesome.
A few, like, romance action thrillers.
Yeah.
Just really fun stuff. And then I did a bunch of, like, drier, like, instructional stuff, too. And, yeah, it was great. It was just... like knowing your, like, I'm going to say that term again, but like knowing your instrument, it really is like playing an instrument and, you know, figuring out the highs and the lows and the, you know, how do you tune it? How do you calibrate it? Like, especially with audiobooks, you fluctuate compared to something like a genre like animation.
Yes.
The fluctuations and the shadings of the voice fall in a much smaller area than animation, which might fluctuate from super high and super low.
Yeah.
And so you... audiobooks, I think, help you tune into your subtlety and your approach on the mic. I mean, it's all, but all of these things, like all genres of voiceover are just an extension of being an actor.
Yeah.
And the more you work and train at acting in general, like that's the thing. Like while all of my voiceover stuff has been going on, I've never, ever stopped being in an acting class or doing a, you know, film, auditioning for TV, doing plays. Like, that is all part of the same fabric.
I agree.
To me.
I feel that's so important.
You
know, just base level revenue stream, like the on-camera actors I know who don't pursue voiceover work or vice versa. And it's like, oh, no one would ever put me on TV. Like, dude, once you get older than 26, buddy, you're a character actor. So, you know what I mean? Like, there's room for you here with the amount of stuff that's being shot. And it might not be, you know, top of show, but hey, man, it's feature day rate.
That's money towards your pension. That's money towards your health care. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And it's relationship building. And it's, you know, it sounds like such an old, like, cliche, but it's so true. Like, yesterday's, like... camera loader, second AC is tomorrow's cinematographer.
Yeah,
you know, and like everybody working here is just it's the industry is just filled with people who are trying to log hours and work and build and treat people with respect and, you know, and work and be part of the community, you know.
Yeah, and you want to be around that as much as possible. Because it's a numbers game.
Sure.
it's a relationship business. And like, also don't, you want to plug your energy into that. Because that's, if that is what you want, is to be part of this community that's always creating, always, you know, building and striving and working and telling stories. Like, you just want to be part of that. And so the more opportunities you make yourself available to, the better. Like, you work on camera so much. I'm just going to fangirl for a second. You were on This Is Us?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was cool. Can I tell you my favorite part of doing This Is Us?
Yeah.
The wardrobe day. When we do the wardrobe fitting,
uh-huh.
Don't get me wrong, I love being on set. I love it. I love being around the actors and my scene partners and the director and the props guy and artificial smoke, like all of it. But Hala, the costume designer on This Is Us, will pull these clothes from the studio archive. They'll go to Paramount, they'll go to Warner Brothers, they'll go to Universal, they'll get the clothes that they need. And then I go do an hour-long wardrobe fitting, and it's put on this outfit from the 60s. Because I play, I'm in that timeline where...
That's right!
Yeah. So Rebecca, I'm Rebecca's dad. When she was six, Rebecca's dad.
Yeah.
But you know, you see me when, yeah. But so like the last pair of pants I wore in that show were worn by an actor in the movie The Grapes of Wrath. Now, you wouldn't know that unless you look in there and it's on the tab and it says I forget the actor's name, but like, it's like the judge in the movie The Grapes of Wrath.
Which,
with the freaking
Like, came out like what, like in the 50s? 50s, right?
Yeah.
That's insane.
With Gregory Peck. And you're like, these pants are part of film history, and I'm wearing them tonight on, you know.
Did you do some lunges? Did you do some squats?
I did lunges. I did squats. I took a bunch of pictures of myself trying to act like a badass homicide detective from the 60s.
That's amazing.
You know, and my hair was all Brill creamed down and had a hard shell. But, like, that set is remarkable. It's a remarkable, and I think that's what it's what I love about all the different spaces that we get to work in this community. Not only the old studios, but like also the recording studios and the people whose name I remember going to a studio and seeing Weird Al Yankovic's name on the ledger signed in right before mine. And there's like, there's some kind of crazy sort of feeling of like,
yes,
I'm in the mix. You guys,
totally, you know, totally. I don't know how much I can say. I had an experience today.
I saw your cryptic tweet.
Yes!
That's all right. You don't have to break anything, but like...
Let me just say that I ran into someone at an audition whose career, whose acting I admire, love, fangirl over.
Yeah.
I think she's amazing. Like one of my favorite characters on TV right now.
Wow.
And she went in to read for the same part I had just gone to read in. And part of me was like, well, all right, that's it. Like,
yeah.
She's going to get it. I hope. Amazing. But the other part of me is like, how cool is it that we're both auditioning for the same part?
That's right. My God,
she's my idol. Like,
that's right.
And then, it's just like, it's one of those moments where it's like, oh, just be grateful. Remember where you are. And in those moments where, you know, you don't have high confidence in yourself that day or that week, you know, all this other stuff happens where constantly your resilience is being tested.
Yes.
And, you know, don't forget, for me, it's a reminder, like, don't forget the magic moments of like, oh my gosh, I just met her. Wow. Wow. This is great.
Yeah.
I'm living it. This is the work.
How do you fortify your resilience when you are, you know, when it's like Breakout, the old video game where the little thing hits your tiny little square. What do you do to strengthen your skill set?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I throw my energy is if I feel like I'm being compromised or something has hit. Because my resilience, as I answer the question I ask you, for myself, my resilience is 100% my confidence.
Uh-huh.
And if something works to undermine my confidence, whether it's a comment from somebody or a feeling I get in a bad audition or a moment or a redirect or something stupid I said in a room with somebody, you know what I mean? Like, it's just something that makes me go, oh, I'm going to go eat some worms. Like, what is your process to restore that?
Ooh, that's a great question. I'm still figuring it out, to be honest.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's, you know, especially, I will say, a lot of the stuff I've been working on the last 2 years is finally coming out. And I'm starting to get a little known for some of the projects I'm working on. And
yeah,
that's a really nice feeling. And it's something, it's like a double-edged sword. In one way, it's like, okay, it doesn't matter if I feel like I sucked at that or if I didn't book that, because I still have this, and this is great,
yeah,
and it's okay, because I have this. But there's also this pressure, okay, now because I have this, I have to continue to keep achieving and performing and booking
right
it the way that I have. And so it's this pressure. The pressure never goes away.
Yeah.
I had an acting teacher who said, the more successful you become, the more problems you'll have.
Huh.
And I absolutely believe it. In a way, some of the problems just change. The problems are just different.
Yeah.
So I guess if I'm having an experience where I feel like I'm not... If it's an experience where I feel like I'm not firing at 100,
mm-hmm,
then I think the two things to remember is like, okay, even if I wasn't firing at 100, I was probably firing at least 75 or above because I trust myself.
Yes.
Two, just keep doing the work.
Hmm.
Like you said, like go to your class, go to approach your next audition. Just understand that you're human and you're not going to fire at 100 every time,
yeah,
but you're still always going to be growing and learning and working. and make the space and time for that, because the that creates that confidence in yourself, in your instrument.
Yes.
Now, if it's something where it's not something I did, but more like a, oh, I put my foot in my mouth. It's not like a creative issue. It's like, oh, I'm just a dork in the world. And that's different. Right. I try to then, you know, remember there's more than these padded rooms and these cameras and these microphones. I text my niece, or I hold my cat, or I, you know, go watch some reality TV. I remember that I'm not. It's hard because what we do, I feel, for me, it's so wrapped in my identity as an actor, as a teller of stories, inhabitor of characters, like that's so wrapped up in my identity. And, you know, the stuff, the attention I get, I want to use for greater good, to make an impact in the world, to help people. But that's not all I am. That's not all we are. We're a composite of so many different things. It's reductive to say, like, acting is my identity. I'm an actor, and that's it. I'm a storyteller, and that's it. No, we're so many things. And so I try to remember that when I'm feeling cruddy about something. It's not always easy.
It's not.
And I need my close friends and my partner to sometimes remind me, like, you're being dumb.
Yeah, knock it off.
Yeah.
I totally agree. I feel like the, you know, you draw your sense of, there was some trend going on. I don't remember what social media platform it was, whether it was Facebook or Instagram or somebody, that was like, I am, these are all the things I am. I am an actor, and I am an improviser, and I'm a father, and a uncle, and a son, and a da 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 da, and all these other things. And it felt like, it felt like the impetus for it was to kind of create like a paragraph version of your skills in Actors Access.
Oh,
that was kind of the vibe of it. But even as I'm talking right now, the thought becomes, that's what I do, but it's not who I am. Yeah. And it's really important to, like, kind of, I wonder if the question of who I am is too ponderous, in a way of like, I know who I am to a bunch of different people, but at the end of the day, I'm a, you know, I'm a soul in a body trying to go get a burger. You
know what I mean? It's a bit esoteric.
Yeah.
Like this question of who am I, like, I think the favorite, I don't know who this quote is attributed to, but I've seen it go around online. Like, you are a ghost riding around in a meat-colored skeleton on a rock that is hurtling through space. Fear nothing. And I love that so much because, yes, we are ghosts inhabiting these vehicles for whatever reason, for whatever purpose, for however we fill our time. There's a lot going on. And
yeah.
We can label ourselves the way we feel comfortable, the way we feel it resonates with our identity, but I think we need to realize that for every person, there's something deeper that goes beyond any label we ascribe.
Yeah. How do you, coming back to that bookmark that I dropped
on Instagram and social media curation,
in those spaces, like how do we maintain the fearlessness, the recklessness as an actor, as an artist, as a content creator, in a space like that feels like, you know, right now I could put up a picture, and if I tag the right people, it would bring the attention of everybody who's a fan of K-pop, for example.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, or voiceover people, or 16 people. How do I preserve my fearlessness and truth in that context? And how, what's your process as a artist self-curator in that?
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to that. I think it's
I mean, I can tell you what I don't like. Cause I see a lot of things I don't like on social media. I feel and I say this, but I'm guilty of it at times too. But I feel like this, there's almost this presentational desperation of like, I'm working today. Look at me. I'm working. Yeah. Isn't this great? I'm working.
That shot, the shot with the microphone in the foreground.
Yes, but I'm guilty of it. I do that. Me too. Like, and part of it I feel is a necessity because I'm going to tell you, because I've promoted projects I've worked on, I've gotten hired for other things because people are like, oh, you were the thing in that. Like, yeah, we want to have you on our thing. I'm like, yeah, great. Like, it has a place, absolutely. But when there is a line, I think, that one crosses where it then starts to smell of desperation. Mm-hmm. And you are not always conscious of that because how can you be objective about your own stuff? I see that. And I also see some people are so open with their lives, and in a way I commend that vulnerability. I love it. I think vulnerability is the best thing a quality an actor can have, but when that, I don't know if that vulnerability always translates to good things on social media, because it's almost like, it's not that I'm guarded on social media, but I like to have some things that are for me in waking life.
I totally agree.
With the people I'm with, and no, you don't get to be privy to that public. And some would argue like, no, but the public wants to see every little part of your life. I don't have enough data to know, like, for me what works yet, but right now I love the dynamic I have with the people who follow me on social. Like, it's a lot of people who are generally like very loving and excited about the shows I work on and who are by extension then very loving and supportive of things I post or pictures of me. And it's like, it's very sweet. And I like letting people in on the good stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not going to always show you the bad stuff because I want to process that myself.
That's a great way of putting it, you know, that it's like these challenges are mine. And I'll if I feel compelled to share these challenges down the road, I will, so that I can do what I can to be someone who can share what it's like on the other side.
Yeah.
But you know, but fussing from inside the darkness, working your way towards the light, sometimes feels like a, you know, maybe a cry for help, or I don't know.
Right. And I don't want to, you know, put down people who really need help.
Sure.
And who that is their coping mechanism. But sometimes it just comes off as a plea for attention and not a genuine.
Yeah.
Like, I don't mean to be critical, but that's what I see. And so that's what I personally try to avoid.
Yeah.
At the same time, I worry like, oh no, are people just going to think I'm positive cheerleader all the time? Because I'm not that either.
Right.
I guess I just try to be honest, but I try to be positive.
Yeah. I think that's the best way to be.
Right? I mean, our job is really fun. Yeah. It's really fun to share aspects of it.
I totally agree.
It's nuts.
How has creating in particular solo performance theater work informed your, not just your on-camera work, but in your voiceover work? How have those two pieces worked together, and how has, in particular, solo show creation affected that?
Well, there's two solo shows that I took around and toured. One was an adaptation of a play written in the 1960s by Japanese playwright Yukio Mishima entitled My Friend Hitler. In which I play the titular role of Adolf Hitler.
Wow.
And this was a very academic exercise. It was an adaptation of a translation that I, you know, in playing Hitler, I used gender construction techniques from the Takarazuka Theater, which I mentioned earlier that I'd studied with.
Yes.
So it was very much an academic exercise I'm fascinated by World War II history.
Yeah.
And especially depictions of Hitler because, you know, I always said this when I was doing the show, it's important that we humanize the people who we perceive as the most evil in the world, because we need to realize they're not monsters that exist outside of us. They are you and I.
That's right.
The wind blows a different way. We could find ourselves doing those same terrible things. And so we need to be vigilant about ourselves rather than say this is something else.
It's easy to label it wrong, abhorrent, mistake. Not me.
Right.
But whereas you, but confronting the Hitler in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did that. I toured that around. It was not comedy. And I found that, wow, a solo 1 hour show about Adolf Hitler or drama doesn't really sell tickets as much. So the next solo show I made was a musical comedy about growing up Muslim in the U.S. And I called it Headscarf and the Angry Bitch. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I'm allowed.
That's okay. No, bitch is fine. For this podcast, things have slid by. It's fine.
Oh, good. And the title is a parody, of course, of Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Oh,
because
yeah.
The musical is all song parodies of different genres.
Oh, wow.
And it was really fun. It got a lot of like notoriety and critical acclaim. And so I was able to tour it around to quite a few places. And it kind of became, I started doing some colleges and universities, and we'd have a Q&A at the end of it to talk about. The show is not autobiographical, but, you know, loosely based on my experiences and other experiences and fictionalized experiences.
Gosh.
And my whole goal with it was to create... you know, so many of the images of Islam in the media are scary.
Yeah.
And I wanted to create a character, somebody that people would laugh at and laugh with.
Awesome.
And love.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, selling out shows in my home state in Indianapolis. And
that's,
I was like,
so fantastic.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, if like 200 people a night are coming to see a Muslim woman in a hijab sing and make jokes, like, there is hope. There is hope. There is hope.
That's right.
So as far as that ties into voiceover,
or how does it help you create character? What's that process like? If character, what
sure.
is it?
Sure. I feel like when you do a solo show, you make a lot of decisions.
Hmm.
You have to make very strong choices. And I've both worked with directors and not worked with directors. I definitely prefer working with a director. But when you're self-directing, you have to make strong choices and you have to stand by them.
Yeah.
And so I certainly think that is helpful in auditioning, you know, in terms of creating characters and, you know, bringing that sensibility to it of like, this is the choice and this is, you know, that confidence and that ability to self-direct, listen back to your audition and, and also the confidence to, and this just comes from auditioning. It's like one take, two take, okay. Like I'm not gonna move on to the next one. There's no time. And probably I got it in the first take anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, man.
But that comes from years of working the muscle.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
And I still struggle with that, too. There are things that I'm like, why am I doing 18 takes of this radio demo audition? But it is that discipline of really being specific and just saying, well, maybe it's because you haven't made a choice.
Mm.
Maybe it's because you're just following the spec and you're doing, you know, and like what I love about my stage experience is it reminds me of that feeling of being entertaining.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like there's, you know, when the audience is connected to you and when they're not.
100%.
And then taking that feeling into a space where your audience is someone that you don't get to see, but tapping into that feeling in yourself of like, am I being entertaining? And even if I don't book it, you know,
yes,
that's something that I have to remind myself all the time when I'm playing stuff back is like, would I continue listening to this character talk for another 30 seconds about Maserati or not?
Yeah. You know what I
mean? Well, that's great.
Yeah. And that, that's, not to mention, I mean, the thing you just pointed out, live performance informs so much of voiceover, you know, because I think that a lot of successful voiceover actors, everyone comes from different disciplines, but I feel like a lot of the people who are super successful have live performance backgrounds, music, improv, comedy, theater, like that, you know, the knowledge of what it feels like to have that other invisible character there, the audience, that's something, a dynamic to play with that can't be forgotten.
100%. And you know, the amount of the listening that happens in there, like I was just talking about this with Terry Notary a couple weeks ago, like this, the importance of that dialogue and really listening.
Yes.
You know, when we're doing auditions for theatrical stuff in particular, where either you're playing off a casting director mm-hmm. in the on-camera world or nobody, the invisible other actor that you're putting into your yeah. ear, or in a video game script where there is no other right. dialogue, complete anti-textural.
Right.
You know, you have to fill those gaps in for yourself.
Yes. Yes. You know? And like, especially, you know, in a solo show where you're playing multiple characters yeah. who are talking to each other, like my friend Hitler solo show, the character Hitler talks to another man who is never there, but you have to hear his response in your reaction, you know? And so that's so helpful in voiceover. Yeah.
I totally agree. And critical.
Yeah.
Dude, I wish we had even more time.
Oh
I can
my
talk
gosh,
to you
that
for
flew
a
by.
I know, doesn't it? It's yeah. shocking. So how can people, because I know you're in Voltron on Netflix, and that's yes. living on Netflix.
Yes.
Which season are you featured in?
In seven and eight.
Seven and eight.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
Young Justice.
Young Justice season 3, which is out on DC Universe now. And the second half of season 3 will drop in June. So
awesome.
Just a couple months away.
Oh, that's so awesome. What an exciting fun thing. What else? Do you have anything else coming out that you can talk about, or anything else that you're excited
yes!
about that's coming?
So for gamers out there, if you play Apex games, season 1 is launching really soon. And I play the AI announcer. You are the Apex champions. That's me you hear praising you for your victory.
That's awesome.
I'm I play a character in League of Legends that was just released, Kayle.
Yeah.
It was a character that they reworked and revamped, and so I voice her.
Awesome.
And then I have some stuff coming up that I can't talk about yet, but I'm super
yep.
excited to share when I can.
Awesome. And how can people find you and watch your see your openness and your positivity?
My positive
and,
honesty.
And your social media profiles. How can people find you?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Zara Fuzzle. And you can also go to ZaraFuzzle.com, my website. And I also have a Facebook fan page, Zara Fuzzle Official.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Dude, it's been so delightful to finally get to just sit and talk. And
yes,
connect.
You're so lovely.
Oh, you are too.
Thank you
so much. This was the greatest. And another shout out again to Juice Studios in Santa Monica.
Thanks, Juice.
Just engineer Scott. Scott, thank you very much. Juice is the best. And hey, and you're the best. Thank you for listening. And there'll be more episodes coming soon. Peace. This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a positive rating. It truly helps. Follow me on Twitter at Kiff VH, or on Instagram at Kiff VH, or on Vero at Kiff VH. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon. Claim victory and depart the field.
Werewolf?
There.